Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you are listening to Total EM. We are back again for the second part of the EMID podcast series, where Patrick Bufuma is interviewing Dr. Nico Cortez-Penfeld. And this time around, they're going to talk about septic arthritis. This is a great breakdown. This was a very helpful and educational discussion. I took away a lot from this. I hope you do too. So let's not delay this any further and get right into the podcast.
This is really cool. I gotta say, this sounds like a great gig you've got with an orthopedic ID. That's
It's wonderful. You know, it's very funny. Like, ID folks are like notoriously like they find like surgeons to be weird, mysterious animals, because we're like we're about as far apart as you can get on the like doctor personality scale.
But, okay.
Like, I've actually found like they're super straightforward. They want to do their job. They don't want to have to deal with the infection stuff. They are cool letting us run the show, and that like that really works for me.
I can imagine you're both groups really want to put the other party in a position to succeed, right? So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a good relationship.
Huh. All right, so I imagine then at this point you've seen your fair share of joint infections, and I gotta say that my positive taps that I've had in the ED always seem to surprise me. I was initially of the mindset that, you know, if it's not super painful or if they could range the knee, then it's probably not septic. And then I have done enough knees where I've seen that, like, even ones that look relatively benign or have been going on for a couple of weeks can and still do seem to be infected. You know, this is relatively limited. I mean, I probably get like 3 or 4 septic knees a year. What have you seen on your end?
I think there is a range, and it really depends on the host. And so, let's talk about this in order. So again, this is really two discussions, because when we talk about septic arthritis, you got your native joint and prosthetic joint, and they're really like two separate diseases. I'll talk mostly about native joint disease because I think that's probably higher yield for your audience. But we'll mention a couple stuff about prosthetic joint infection. So first of all, if you look at the epi studies of folks coming into the ER with a hot swollen joint, about 1 in 5 actually end up being septic arthritis. And it really should be monoarticular. If you have someone coming in with multiple joint effusions, that should send you down the rheumatic disease pathway, or maybe something viral like parvo or chikungunya in a returning traveler. Someone who does have multiple joints that truly are infected, that should make you think about a disseminated infection. Like, either they've got gonorrhea or they've got something showering bacteria into the blood, like endocarditis or septic thrombophlebitis in an injection drug user. If you look at all cases of bacterial septic arthritis, at least half of them are going to be knees. Something to be on the lookout for are in your injection drug users, the septic arthritis of the sternoclavicular or sternomanubrial joints. And that has to do with the venous blood supply, which basically takes the bacteria from when they shoot up straight to those joints. And that can be a tricky diagnosis because those folks will often present with either chest pain or shoulder pain. And then, you know, no one examines the chest other than auscultating. And then they get, you know, kind of misled and go down the cardiac pathway. When really, if you like actually physically inspected the chest, you see there's some septic arthritis there. In terms of what are the most common presenting symptoms, I mean, it's inflammation in the joint. I think far and away the most common symptom is just pain. And you know, it is often, just like you said, not a slam dunk where they've got calor, rubor, tumor, all that stuff. It can also be just isolated pain. You'll notice within prosthetic joint infections, those guys will actually sometimes complain of instability, either actual falls or feeling like their leg is going to give out.
Huh.
And that's because the infected arthroplasty starts to loosen because the bacteria are eating away at the bone that it's seated in. Systemic symptoms are often absent in elderly patients and patients with prosthetic joint infections. So you can't necessarily be reassured by the absence of fever or chills in those populations. Younger folks who genuinely have septic arthritis often will have at least a low-grade fever. I agree with you in that I often don't find the acuity of presentation to be that helpful. You know, most people will say days rather than hours or weeks, but you can get tricked on that. Most people will tell you that their pain was precipitated by some blunt trauma, but you know, you get the same stories with folks coming in with inflammatory arthropathies. Similarly, if you look at the host status, although there are a bunch of things that predispose to septic arthritis, diabetes, HIV, smoking, being old, blah, 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 none of these things have particularly good negative predictive values. And even someone who doesn't have any risk factors for septic arthritis can easily still have it. We run into the same problem with the physical exam. Hot swollen joints can also be gout. They can also be rheumatic disease. So I think kind of the long story short is that if you are thinking septic arthritis, you need to get labs and you need to put a needle into the joint.
So let's go on to labs. Which ones are actually useful? I hate to say it, but I do tend to be a big fan of SED rates and CRPs when there's some diagnostic uncertainty, but they're also bumped up with gout. So What do I do here?
I think the key word in what you said is when you have diagnostic uncertainty, because whether or not those tests are going to be helpful really depends on pretest probability. So if you look at the diagnostic parameters of elevated white count, elevated ESR, and elevated CRP for septic arthritis, they're all pretty much the same. They have decent, not great sensitivity, like 70 to 90%, and they have real lousy specificity, like 30 to 50%. And if you put those numbers together and you calculate positive and negative likelihood ratios, you find that each of those tests on their own doesn't move the needle that much. Now, on the other hand, if you've got your white count, your ESR, and your CRP, and they're all stone cold normal, and you can combine those negative likelihood ratios, that actually does move the needle a little bit. So what I would say is, you know, if you're starting off with a pretty high pretest probability, this guy's a pretty good chance they might have septic arthritis. There's no point in waiting for those labs to come back. Just go do an arthrocentesis. But if you're starting off pretty skeptical, I think it's maybe reasonable to wait for those to come back. And if they're all negative, that really ought to move that lower down on your differential. The other thing I'll say is that the calculus there is more complicated if it's a prosthetic versus a native joint infection. Because if we're tapping a joint that an arthroplasty that we don't really think is infected, now we're risking introducing an infection. And like prosthetic joint infection is kind of a beast to treat, like months of antibiotics, multiple surgeries. So, you know, if you have the luxury of having an orthopedist come take a look at the joint, if you're unsure whether or not it's infected, I would say definitely go do that. The last thing I'll say about blood tests is I'm glad you didn't mention ProCal, because ProCal doesn't really have much utility in septic arthritis. There are multiple studies showing that you can have low ProCal in septic arthritis, so you shouldn't be using that to rule out that diagnosis.
These people that are in the gray zone, what am I doing with them? You know, there's this for the white blood cell count for synovial fluid, when you're in that in-between phase, it's not a slam dunk. Are you erring on the side of caution and treating? Are you waiting for cultures to come back and smears? What do I do there?
Let's start at the beginning. So when we put a needle on a joint, we want to send our cell count, a differential, a Gram stain, and culture and microscopy for crystals. If you are lucky and you're able to pull a ton of fluid out of the joint, go ahead and put some of it in a set of blood culture bottles, because that's actually been shown to improve the microbiologic yield. Really? Just remember, you also have to send a normal sterile tube so that they can get a Gram stain and all those other studies. And obviously, put the needle in the joint before you hang the antibiotics, you know, if the person isn't crashing. The leukocyte count in synovial fluid is not something I would say we should look at as a strict cutoff. The higher it is, the higher the specificity. And in fact, even a cell count above, you know, like 25,000 can be pretty subjective if the differential is also abnormal. So actually, if you look at the differential, greater than 90% SEGS is actually more predictive of septic arthritis than greater than 25,000 white cells. And the two of them together are about as predictive as, actually more predictive than greater than 50,000 white cells. So I find the differential is often worth looking at, and would consider the white count kind of as a spectrum versus as a strict cutoff. The other thing I will mention before I forget is that prosthetic joints aren't vascularized spaces. So you cannot interpret synovial fluid cell counts in the same way. Even a few thousand white blood cells from a total knee or a total hip arthroplasty is suggestive of infection. They really shouldn't have white cells in there.
Really?
Huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. My answer for that is for native joint infection, the stakes are lower. If you've sent the cultures off antibiotics, we know the yield of that is going to be at least 80%. And so, you know, you do have a pretty good chance of securing the diagnosis by culture. Also, we've got RTC data showing 2 weeks is probably plenty for septic arthritis these days. So I don't think, like, from a stewardship standpoint, we need to spend a lot of time hand-wringing about, like, well, what if we make the surgical cultures negative, or you know, what if we accidentally treat someone? I mean, I think if you have a decent pretest probability of septic arthritis and the labs are not reassuring, I would just go ahead and treat. Like I said, prosthetic joint infection, different story. I think there we would get orthopedic surgery involved and try and not give antibiotics, so that if they do decide this is infected, we're going to surgery, we can actually get a culture and an organism, because prosthetic joint infection is a different story. And then you're signing your patient up for anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months of antibiotics, multiple surgeries. And so I think there we really need to work harder to identify a specific pathogen. Native joint arthritis, lower stakes.
We have a native joint infection, sort of a slam dunk case. Maybe they're febrile, but they're not crashing. They've got, you know, 300,000 WBCs on their synovial fluid. You sent off cultures. Some people will say give antibiotics. Some people say wait and we'll wash them out, meaning take them to the OR. Is there a time where we should be holding off and waiting for OR cultures, or just sort of start them on something and get cultures from the synovial fluid that we get from the arthrocentesis?
I think it's perfectly reasonable to hold cultures if someone isn't systemically ill, they're not crashing, and your orthopedic surgery team moves pretty quick and they're going to wash them out later that day. I think that's totally reasonable. If there's going to be a prolonged delay, there is at least, you know, like, kind of theoretical concern that sustained increase in intra-articular pressure can start to compromise the vascular supply to the joint space and to the bone and lead to avascular necrosis. And that can, you know, jack up a person's joint kind of long term and push them towards needing an arthroplasty. So if there isn't going to be prompt surgical intervention, I would go ahead and start the antibiotics. And obviously, if someone's systemically ill, I would start the antibiotics. But I think it's reasonable to hold off if they're going straight to surgery.
Want to go into some other tips and tricks that you may have here. You had mentioned the prosthetic joints complaining more that they feel like it's unstable or feel like their leg's going to give out. I thought that was a really good tip. Anything else on when we should be more concerned, whether like for a sternoclavicular infection or a wrist or an ankle, any other pearls or pitfalls for those?
We talked about sternal septic arthritis in people who inject drugs, sternoclavicular sternomandibular. That's something to watch out for. Folks who have, this isn't necessarily a who presents with this disease, but people who do present with this disease have a different microbiology. So shoulder septic arthritis and shoulder arthroplasties, for some reason, have a ton of P. acnes, which is now called Cutibacterium acnes infections. Don't ask me why, I don't know. But a quirk of the human microbiome, those guys get C. acnes infections. If you're seeing septic arthritis in a hand, you should be asking about bites, bite wounds, because people tend to get septic arthritis because they get bitten by their cat or their dog, or they punch somebody and now they have, you know, Eikenella in their joint. Or, you know, people may, if they have non-bite injuries that are similar, they may... maybe have something you have to tease out of them. So I'll give you an example. When I was a fellow working at the Houston VA, I saw a guy who was worked as a farmer, and he had been out working on his fences and slashed open one of his metacarpal joints on some barbed wire and decided he would clean that out by sucking on it. And he gave himself a terrible Eikenella septic arthritis. Oh, so if you see a septic arthritis in the hand, you should, you know, collect some more history about that. Let's see what else. So the thing, if you've got someone who's coming in after a traumatic injury to a joint with a septic arthritis, so say, for example, you know, someone comes in after they were in a motorcycle accident, they tore their knee open, we should really be thinking much more broadly. So that is someone who we need to send fluid and operative cultures for fungi and AFBs in addition to routine bacteria. And we should probably cover more broadly with mesenchymal vanc and tip tabs, because they've got the outside world in their joint now.
So you're talking about like an open infection?
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
This is sort of moving away from infected knees, but you bring up this point about trauma being a risk factor. I've sort of seen, at least with spinal infections, that spinal trauma, like if you have like a transverse spinous process fracture, that mm-hmm. those can be risk factors for infections, which sort of strikes me as weird, and I can't put those pieces together. Is it like that for other joints? Is that something unique to the spine?
Absolutely. There is a phenomenon called locus resistentia minora. I may be butchering that Latin. Bone and joint infections tend to arise in areas of previous trauma, and the idea, and they actually tend to be precipitated by trauma. And the idea is that the injured bone has suddenly got a disrupted blood supply, and it's got blood pooling in that space, which provides a wonderful little culture media and interruption of the normal kind of flow of immune cells to that area, and sets up kind of a haven that bacteria can invade and set up shop in. And so a very common story will be, you know, someone had a prior fracture in their arm, and then they had some minor blunt trauma to their arm years later, and then all of a sudden they developed osteomyelitis there, or, you know, septic arthritis if it's in a joint space. So that's actually a pretty well-defined phenomenon.
Hmm. Interesting. All right. By the way, I love how you periodically refer to a patient as the host. I think it's a very ID-centric.
Yeah. I mean, I'm primarily interested about killing the bugs, and it's great if my patient survives to it. That's not true, but that's sometimes how it feels.
All right. What else do you think would be important for the EM world to know about joint infections?
Gosh, you know, if they're not systemically ill, bone and joint infections, you know, rarely progress rapidly to sepsis. So feel free to like leave them alone from an antibiotic perspective, so we can go get some operative cultures. I feel like that's a big deal in diabetic foot infections. Although, you know, I'm also sympathetic to the ED2, because those are immunocompromised folks, and they can crash, and often they will not present with obvious signs of illness, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're hypotensive and go into the ICU. But if you have someone who's not sick, they don't have a raging soft tissue infection, they've just, you know, they've got an ulcer and it looks infected, and there's probably some infection in the bone under there, yeah, feel free to leave that alone and let us get some biopsies, and we can spare the patient a long course of multiple IV antibiotics and maybe just give them something targeted instead.
Speaking of which, what's your go-to drug for joint infections? We didn't actually cross that off the list.
Oh, sure. Something that's been controversial in the bone and joint infection field for a while is whether or not oral antibiotics are adequate, or if it needs to be IV, or if it needs to be IV up front. But if you look at the published clinical data, and most recently a big randomized controlled trial called Oviva.
Oviva, yeah.
Yeah, the spring in New England Journal, that showed, we just slam dunk, oral antibiotics are just as well. They prove non-inferiority. Actually, there was like some signal towards maybe they were working better than the IV drugs. So I don't think that we should be afraid of oral antibiotics for bone and joint infections. For the sake of reliability, I usually start with vancomycin. But once I have an organism and I know the susceptibilities, you know, for staph, I would switch to Bactrim. I would switch to doxycycline or minocycline. Particularly if it's going to be a short course, you know, like a septic joint versus osteomyelitis, I might give one nasalid. More and more, we are doing this combination of a fluoroquinolone plus rifampin. I mean, that's kind of like, I don't know, it's like bringing a nuke to a gunfight, but, you know, the data shows it does work really well. But, you know, I think all of these things are totally reasonable.
And so you're primarily just doing gram positive.
Yeah. So I guess we didn't talk about that, but so in the absence of, you know, specific things that make you think of specific organisms, like we're talking about bioins and Pasteurella and Echinella, if you just look at plain old bacterial septic arthritis, greater than 2/3 is going to be strep and staph. I mean, the number three are probably staph aureus, coagulase negative staph, and group B strep. And so those are really the things you need to target, particularly if you don't have a gram negative either on your stain or in your culture. Times when you should be thinking about adding empiric gram negative therapy is really, do you think it's disseminated gonorrhea, or did you have trauma, or, you know, something else introduced into the joint space? But mostly strep and staph.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time.
All right, that wraps up this podcast. Again, thank you, Patrick and Nico, for coming on to talk all about clindamycin and then septic arthritis, as was discussed in this podcast. Make sure to let us know what you think and if you have any questions. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.